This is Their Life Story Podcast with Robin Levine. I have always believed that everybody has something to teach all of us. In this series of interviews, I will talk to all types of people in order to learn from and be inspired by them and their life stories. I'm really happy and excited to announce my new partnership with Change Toothpaste. They've eliminated the need for the toothpaste tube. They're mostly online, but they ship to you really quickly, and it's a bunch of pellets that come in a compostable pouch. I would like to give a shout out to fellow podcaster Christina Haydanis from Opening the Playbook. She does an amazing job interviewing women in sports, and you get a lot of insights on athletes, a lot of them Canadian, that you might not otherwise learn about, but it's really worth it. My guest this week is Zach Shum. Zach is the founder and director of Obabaka Consulting. They're a creative and digital marketing studio for environmental groups, and they're non-for-profit. In this episode, Zach recalls a fearful incident where he fell in the water and got attacked by a family of beavers. And he talks about working on getting a major upgrade for the water treatment plant for the city of Vancouver, as well as the effects that antidepressants have on salmon.
Zach, thanks a lot for taking the time to talk to me.
Oh yeah, thanks for making it happen.
Yeah, you bet. The first thing I wanted to ask was, what was it like growing up in Ontario and going to a prep school? What was it like going to prep school?
Prep school is kind of like a blanketed term for private school. Which was dope. I went to an art school, so it was really nice to kind of like be a teen in art school in Toronto. It was great. And I love growing up in Ontario, spending the summers in canoes and like lake country. And yeah, I feel like it's funny. I feel like a lot of my friends are just like from there, you know, as we live in BC, there's going to be a lot of transition there for sure. But yeah, I loved it. I loved it.
What kind of art were you doing when you were in high school?
Fine art. I was like a fine art to graphic design kid.
And you originally went to Queens for design and dropped out?
I didn't go to Queens. I went to OCAD for a day.
Oh, for one day.
For one day. I did like orientation day. And before then, kind of like the summer before I went to school, I had the seed planted of doing environmental work and environmental studies, and kind of like pulled the plug right after first few classes and just decided like the pursuing something creative on a professional basis wasn't really for me. But I get the kudos of going to design school for a day, so.
Do you still do design stuff just for like for your own passion?
For sure, yeah. It's definitely like what fills my cup a lot of time, and I spend a lot of time just playing around. I do pretty much all of our Obabaka stuff. And kind of just like friends projects and stuff. But yeah, I really enjoy doing it on like a non-professional basis.
So why did you like switch to environmental science at Waterloo? How did you know that that was something you wanted to pursue?
Yeah, it was a big swing. Like I definitely grew up, as I'm sure you can relate to, you know, like skateboarding, snowboarding, and just wanted to do like skateboard graphics, you know, 12-year-old kid who got my whole career path mapped out and I'm just gonna make skateboards. And then kind of when I got exposed to different environmental issues in high school through like classes and just seeing it on a firsthand basis, definitely opened my eyes quite a bit. And in that sort of like grade 12 to university summer, proposed development was kind of being protested near my family's place in Southern Ontario. So it was in a protected wetland area, but the developer basically had gone through a number of loopholes and kind of prolonged their different permitting. So there, a neighbor of ours was fighting it and kind of enlisted my help to do some like creative stuff, some communication stuff, get the word out. And I think that was kind of like what set me on my like a more kind of rigid path, and then realized that environmental work is like really what I want to be doing. I felt really strongly about it, and I wanted to be able to do something in like a more proactive way than being adjacent to it. So it's kind of been, that was kind of like the match, I guess.
Were you guys successful to drive the developers out?
You know, funny you should ask, as of like 3 months ago, this started what, 12 years ago? As of 3 months ago, yes. I'm like,
wow. Yeah.
Now it's protected under.
Oh my gosh.
Jurisdiction, yeah.
You staved them off for 12 years.
Crazy. It was like, I can't really take credit. I wasn't really the brains behind the operation, but it's a crazy story. I'm like really, really stoked to have been a part of it at any stage, and a huge win, huge win.
So what were you guys protecting exactly? Like birds on a wetland? Like, or was it bird habitat?
Yeah, so I don't know if you're familiar with kind of like Ontario geography, but I'm sure a lot of your listeners are. There's the basically in Lake Country in Southern Ontario, Central Ontario, it's just real marshy around the lakes. So you get these wetland areas and it's like, you know, we're talking lots of square footage, probably like 40-acre, 50-acre wetlands. And a lot of them have a lot of ecological significance in habitat, breeding ground for different like invertebrates, lots of tree species and stuff that are being increasingly more protected as more invasive species come in. So it is sort of like a ecological hotspot, something that should probably be studied a lot more, researched a lot more. But the ecological significance was kind of like the saving grace to it all.
That was kind of the first stepping stone for you. And then what did you learn in school that kind of gave you the tools to do it as like a profession?
Yeah, that was definitely the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of I was aware of these issues, didn't really know what I could do with it and how my skills would come into play, but kind of being involved on a ground level in that was huge. And then throughout school, I was always like involved in a voluntary position or interning in the summers and stuff for different groups. So kind of created a path there, but I would basically the process, which is so funny to think about now, was that I would go into I'd email a group, you know, March as the school year is winding down, being like, I do so and so. They're like, great, university student, bring him in. He knows how to work the internet and do the artsy stuff, like perfect. So I kind of like fell into all these communications, digital marketing, social media roles and stuff. And then in school, I was studying like the nitty gritty environmental science. So I have a bachelor of environmental science, but all this kind of like lived experience and work experience in communications and activism and kind of combining the two and then pursuing some more formal education in communications and digital marketing. It's kind of like where I'm at now, but it was definitely a pretty like organic process.
So are you going back for more school now? Is that what you're saying?
No, now I'm done with the learning for now. Always learning, but done with the schooling for now.
What kind of volunteer organizations did you work with when you're in school?
A bunch. Honestly, someone asked me this recently and I like started listing them and got lost. but I did like the full spectrum from like Greenpeace Canada to like local efforts in the Grand River region, in and around Georgina, like Southern Ontario. Yeah, kind of like bounced around a lot. It wasn't necessarily just like super formal things. It was kind of like, hey, here's what I'm doing with the school project. How can I relate that to what you're doing?
With all those projects and like volunteering for the different organizations, were you able to make lots of friends and contacts that's still a super big part of your life now?
Totally, totally. I think that like the connections and relationships I made with these people while I was in and around is like I owe everything to it for sure. And the amount of people I have is sort of like a mentor relationship, kind of like a sounding board, is 99% of the reason where I'm at now, for sure.
So we went on and you just did all this volunteering out of the goodness of your heart, but that's kind of been one of your biggest strengths now is all those contacts, hey?
For sure. I don't think I I don't think like the 18-year-old dumb me knew how beneficial it would be, but like real glad I did it. I was definitely in a place of privilege enough where I didn't have to be working 40 hours a week while I was in school. And I'm glad I took the time to do it, but it's definitely, everything pays off. Everything comes out in the wash for sure.
So why did you move from Waterloo to BC?
I moved for work, actually. You know, I like, that's not fair. I put the excuse on work, but growing up skateboarding, snowboarding stuff, this is like, I wanted to be here forever. So kind of once I found the opportunity to do it, pulled the plug, shipped out, and yeah, never looked back.
Did you move to Vancouver?
Yeah, I moved to Vancouver. I moved to North End and been playing it here. I did a summer out in your neck of the woods and you glue it. And yeah.
Was that your first summer in BC? Like second?
Second or third? Second.
What did you learn from working out here at Central West Coast Forest Society?
Oh, I learned a ton. I got so much appreciation for everybody over there. And I think what they're doing is like really on the right side of the fence in terms of where nonprofit groups are operating. So for anyone not familiar too, they do salmon habitat restoration on the west coast of Vancouver Island. So when you compare that to your traditional nonprofit group who's canvassing, campaigning, putting out their own, like maybe a research paper, petition, stuff like that, they are really doing more like in the field engineer type work, rebuilding these streams that have been blown out for salmon habitat. And that kind of comes back to the root cause of that a lot of the salmon populations are diminished because of lack of habitat, increased industry and stuff like that. So I think it's a really cool approach to environmental work, and it's like it's not necessarily what it's come off of, but I think that that's like, yeah, that's the root of environmental work in my mind. So I definitely learned a lot about how to operate at that level, how to be more like practical. It was a pretty eye-opening experience. It was really, really rad.
And then you went from there to Patagonia, Vancouver for 3 or 4 years?
So I actually I started working with Patagonia in Toronto, and they shipped me out to Vancouver. And when I was here, I took advantage of a program they have where you get to intern for a nonprofit group. So the group I picked was Central West Coast, and that was how that whole opportunity came about, which is so cool. Like you're basically, Patagonia is your employer is paying you your regular salary to go work for someone else.
What an amazing company.
Yeah, it's crazy. I like beside myself that it happened. And yeah, it's like feels like one of those things where you like picked up a wallet off the ground, tried to contact the person, give them back their like $500,000 in cash, and they're like, just keep it, you know.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a bit more about what you did for Patagonia?
Yeah.
You environmental coordinator?
Yeah. So in Vancouver, basically we run a fund to give money to different groups in the area, nonprofit groups, environmental groups, and run a bunch of events, stuff like that. So we can get our resources to the work that the company is in business to support. So I was largely responsible for distributing the fund and trying to find where that money was going, and kind of managing partners for events, putting together unique stuff. Like we did a tools day, so it's tools for grassroots activists, kind of talking about the power, like, you know, ran the gamut of everything from social media to sustainable fundraising, stuff like that. But that was a really, really cool role, really cool opportunity, really great team of people. And yeah, like sad to still not be doing it, to be totally honest. But
did you think that you'd kind of stay there forever and then something changed your mind?
That's a good question. I don't know if I'm really one of those people that thinks I'll be doing anything forever. I definitely, like, my brain runs faster than any part of my body ever will. But it definitely got me really excited, that, like, the prospect of doing that for a really long time. No one left with, like, any bad blood or anything. And yeah, honestly, like, I could do that job forever, for sure. It's hard. It's a hard company to leave. It's a hard role to leave, because you're, like, you're on the back end of supporting all this work that means so much to you, and you have a huge toolbox at your feet. You can use whatever you want. So, yeah.
What were some of the foundations that you got to work with when you were there with Patagonia?
That's a good question. We was there for 4 years. There's going to be like a couple dozen here, but some, like, the biggest that I've
the highlights
with now are would be, like, local in operation, Georgia Strait Alliance, Raincoast Conservation Foundation. We do a lot of work with Central West Coast. A group now called Echo Conservation Society, used to be called Wildlife Defense League, did a lot of work with them. Watershed Watch Salmon Society. Yeah, those are all the groups that I still, like, functioning, working in relationships with.
Are those mostly groups that are, like, just looking to preserve ecosystems for all types of wildlife, like fish and things that we need in the food chain?
Yeah, those are all, I mentioned those ones because maybe those are, like, the causes more in my heart, to be totally transparent. But yeah, those are all environmental conservation and our salmon habitat rehabilitation groups. So from an ecosystem perspective, those would be kind of like the forefront of what we're looking at for environmental work.
In the background, I see you got a picture of orcas and you got a picture of salmon. Is that kind of the things you really care about?
I care about it all. I think, like, I have, like, a pretty intrinsic attachment to conservation as a whole. I'm not necessarily one of those people, like, approaches environmental protection from, like, a snowboarding lens or anything like that. I think it's just, like, it is wonderful and deserves to be celebrated and protected as is. And these photos, to be entirely honest, like, just match the aesthetic of what I want my office to look like.
That's a good answer. Can you tell me some good memorable stories of, like, an adventure you had or time in nature that really sticks out in your memory?
Well, I got lots. Growing up, we would go on a lot of canoe trips. We spent a lot of time in, like, Northern Ontario, Temagami, Algonquin sort of stuff. Yeah, that's probably, like, you know, what you'd call your formative years, whatever.
Yeah.
And yeah, I got, like, wow, this is a tough question. lots of, like, hilarious stories, like swimming with beavers.
That's awesome.
Which is, like, crazy. Me and my friends call it, like, yeah, it was like Zach almost got drowned by a beaver.
So you actually almost got drowned by a beaver?
You know, no censorship. We had two containers of cookies. One were edibles, one weren't. We ate the edibles by accident. I went for a swim. Bunch of beavers surrounded me in this, like, whirlpool type fashion. It was crazy. It was, like, super chaotic. This is, like, a real memory. This isn't, like, my own interpretation. It's documented. And it was hilarious. That's, like, my, like, fondest, most funniest memory.
That's an amazing story. Thanks, Zach. That made my whole day.
Hell yeah.
You took a chance. You knew that could have been the weed cookies, but you just risked it.
Yeah, like, definitely in the back of my mind, I was hoping they'd be the weed cookies, and and it all panned out.
Wow, that's a legendary story that probably no one else can say they had the same experience.
I hope not. That'd be crazy though. There's just this, like, secret community of beavers that just waits for people to, like, eat a bunch of weed cookies.
So why did you left Patagonia? Did you feel like there was stuff that you couldn't do there that you wanted to do on your own? Or did you feel like you wanted freedom? Or why did you leave to start a nonprofit? And what was it like once you left? Was it scary, or was it everything you wanted it to be?
Yeah, I left. I wouldn't say I was planning on it, but it's definitely in the back of my head to do my own thing. I've always had like the march the beat of my own drum type of spirit. And I think that where I found my role in environmental work was really specific, and what I can cater to and what we do with Obavica was really specific. So I'd kind of like in the last sort of like few months, maybe a year of me at Patagonia, I was definitely trying to plant the seed, trying to see how we can make it work there. Took the idea to a couple other foundations as well and didn't really bite. So it became pretty clear that like, if I want to do this thing, I have to do it on my own. Which is its own conversation, whether it's like worth starting a new nonprofit sort of thing in today's world when there's so many folks doing really great work. So it kind of got to a point where I knew really clearly what I wanted to do, and the only way to do it was to do it my own way. So in August last year, I should lead up to this. In my last few months in Patagonia, I was working like three jobs, trying to scratch together as much money as possible, knowing I wouldn't make any income for like 6 to 8 months, which is crazy. Looking back at it, it's like, I don't know what, my eyes were bleeding, you know, it's like keyboard smashing for 45 hours a day, and kind of came out the other side with Obavica, which is for, and we can backtrack on this too, is like we're a not-for-profit digital marketing studio for environmental groups. So the idea was really came from like, I could freelance and do all this stuff for groups, bring them digital marketing resources because I know the landscape, I know what nonprofit work looks like. And kind of like to extrapolate on that, I was like, I wonder if I could do this as a nonprofit, be able to subsidize my rates by doing our own fundraising and be able to scale this out in the future.
So when you're a nonprofit, like how does it work? Like you have to have money to live. So, and people want to donate, but they want their money to go to a cause normally. But for you, you're kind of more like a consultant.
Yeah. Yeah. We would be like digital marketing consultants by definition. The way the nonprofit works is we sell merch. We have I Bird for Whales hats, bumper stickers, and a couple other like fun things that go a pretty long way in terms of keeping our lights on. And then contract out people when we need additional hands. And in terms of like a living wage and stuff, depending on what our scale and scope of clients are at the time, we pay ourselves. And I think that's really, really important as like a 26-year-old guy who's worked his whole life in environmental work. His whole life, I say that like I've lived a long life. I think it's really important that environmental work is a job and it's a paying job. Like I think volunteering is great and you can reach a lot of new peaks with it, but I really believe in like making a formidable, beneficial career out of doing environmental work.
So when somebody, yeah, I agree too. Like if you have the skills, you shouldn't have to do them for free. And like, you shouldn't be like just getting by. So when somebody hires you, like, are they kind of hoping to get like more, is it almost like they're using you so they can get their like message out? And like, it's like, you're kind of like their advertising marketer, or is it more than that?
Yeah, pretty much. So we basically want to partner with groups who are very mission driven. They have their goal. So for example, Central West Coast's goal is to build salmon habitat. We would come in and do their digital marketing. So stuff like social media, newsletter, SEO builds, kind of all these things that come at a really high cost typically, but we'll come in and do it. So we can essentially be their megaphone. We can be these ones executing it. Their time is still spent on their mission of building salmon habitat. So the idea is that we don't create a burden. We provide a direct benefit and they can focus on what they're doing, and we can focus on digital marketing resources that build them support, bring them funds, bring them eyeballs, all the things they need. And the idea is like, you know, it's same as anything else. You're specializing services. Like that's what we're good at. That's what we do. And that's what they're good at. And that's what they do.
Is it hard sometimes to make it work? Like, is it hard to market for things? Is it like, is there a barrier, or is it like, have you got it pretty dialed?
There's definitely a barrier for sure. It's in the world right now, post COVID, it's hard to find work at all. We went from having a full roster of 5 clients to nothing, like literally overnight. So we're clawing back for sure. And I think marketing in that goes through waves, just like anything else. Like right now, this week, as we're talking, we're waiting to hear how many electoral votes Biden needs to win. That's a biased way of saying it. And people's appetite for listening just really isn't that much. So that'll also be echoed in like times of lull where there isn't too much going on. People really feel passionate about these issues, especially in the neck of the woods that we live. And it's quite easy to tell a story about a really great group doing really great work. And if you know what you're doing, you can get a lot of support pretty quickly. But we definitely have to be in tune with what's going on in the world and how we can be sensitive to that, and how we can kind of operate in that in a way that makes sense. Because, you know, emotional fatigue is real. And in 2020, like I think the whole world's been pushed their limits, it's really tricky to navigate who wants to hear what. And yeah.
Are you able to use all your contacts with your work to like help you do one project too? Like, are you able to like draw on people that you know to help you with certain like campaigns that you're doing?
100%. Like people always ask if sort of a Bobco was something I started on my own, which like matter of factly, yes, but I'm like so indebted to all my contacts and all my friends and all my peers and colleagues. Like we get so much help. We make so many phone calls. We have so many opinions. Like I think that's sort of the way that I operate as a person. Like I like hearing other opinions. I don't think an opinion's wrong from anybody, and it's always worth hearing. And we reach out to a lot of our contacts a lot. Just as sounding boards, it's really appreciated. It's really like what keeps our lights on, what keeps my head straight for sure.
What's like some hard fought lessons that you have learned in this line of work or even personally in your life?
Nothing comes easy. Nothing comes easy. I think that I've done a lot of my own kind of growing up and starting this. And I definitely started with my head in the sand about like what do Wabba can do, what our capabilities are. And I didn't necessarily spend as much time as I should have kind of listening what people need. And I think like the biggest lesson I've learned in the last like 6 months, especially, is just like people need to be talking less and listening more. For sure. And I think if you're starting a business or you work for someone else and you're just doing your own thing, there's like a lot of people in the world that have a lot of lived experience and a lot of really credible experience. And I think that like those, especially people in positions of privilege, need to be listening to that and like more sincere in how they operate.
Do you feel like sometimes you try to reach out to people and you need their help and they just don't respond?
Oh man. Yeah. Oh yeah. I got ghosted on a meeting 4 different times this week. So maybe I should preface that. That's not really like me reaching out to people for help. I definitely try and be like pretty considerate of who I'm reaching out to and what their bandwidth is, but like everyone's real busy all the time. And it's a big ask to be like, hey, can I get your feedback on this one thing? You know, like sometimes we'll send out a document or something going out in the next little while, send it to 15 people, ask for requests ask for feedback by a certain date and I'll get no responses, which is fine, you know, but it's a big ask.
And that's even within your friend group a lot of the time? Within your peer group?
Yeah. That's like, I would say it's more rare than not. People have been really, really supportive and people have shared a lot of kind words and spent a lot of time and a lot of brain power working on what we're working on, which is really great.
Yeah, sometimes with my podcast, I'll be like, oh, this person would be amazing. And then I'll research them for an hour just to give them an email that I think they'll respond to. And then nothing. Like I want it so bad. I want the reply so bad, and I'll just be waiting, checking my email every day, and I won't get it.
Yeah, it's a tough game. It's like, yeah, the accessibility. I feel like it's, a lot of it just goes like the accessibility we have to people, cool people. Like, you know, you want to talk to a pro snowboarder? Where's my phone? You know, like I'll. Yeah. You know, like it's like. When you have so many windows and you're a person of interest, you get hit up a lot, which like at some point is just totally unsustainable.
I know. A lot of the people I reach out to, I'm like, they've been on every show, every famous interviewer has interviewed them. Like, why would they answer me? I get it. But at the same time, it just would be so nice.
It would be so nice. Yeah. I think there's a lot of value in like in personal connections. And I think that we live a really special existence in that way through doing the things that you're really passionate about. And like, I think we see this a lot, like geographically here is like, I make a lot of my friends through snowboarding or whatever. And you like, you know, those are human relationships. And that goes a lot further than any kind of like DM would ever go. But if you're like, and I think it's pretty easy to embed yourself in that community if that's the thing you want to be doing, like to make intentional friend groups of shared interests is a pretty like special thing. And I think a really special thing when you have passions like ourselves.
Yeah, I've been lucky because I'm expanding my group as I keep reaching out to different people or people tell me to interview different people. I keep making all these cool contacts. What are some qualities that you like in yourself that make you effective in your life and your job?
Whoa. I don't like too much about myself.
Everybody has strengths.
I think my like MO in life is just to be real open-minded. I'm not a guy who really like forms an opinion, takes a position on something and is really hard-headed about it. I'm an environmentalist that reads like the National Post. I think that just having an open mind and like listening to everybody's side of the story is hugely important. That's definitely something like my dad taught me, whether he knows it or not. But that's like, yeah, I think I'll take that one in the bank.
What are some qualities that you like in other people?
Well, I like having good conversations. I like that we're doing this now. I think it's great to just like riff off each other. And I think like a genuine curiosity is really cool. We like, the same goes with what we were saying before, you know, like we live in a world where you can get everything all the time so quick. And it's pretty easy to like tune into a video for 20 seconds and tune out. But to have like a genuine curiosity and be able to like engage with people at a high level is really, really important. I think something I look for in my friends and like colleagues and peer relationships is just like, how are you as a human? Like, are you interested in what we're doing? You want to know more? How do you want to get that information?
Do you think that better relationships among like different groups would kind of solve a lot of environmental problems?
100%. Yeah, for sure. I think like if we could somehow get more people to have like civil conversations, I think we'd be looking at like a whole different planet, to be totally honest with you. I think that will like span way past environmental issues, but the amount of people that are just bullheaded about things they don't know too much about is pretty wild. I think that there's needs to be a lot more like roundtable discussions. And I think that there needs to be a lot of people who are speaking like just outside their bubble. Like I was kind of realizing this too when I was sharing, like, I think I posted a meme about the election in my story And I was like, the only people that are going to read this are people who think just like me, like they're following me. They know what I'm speaking about and they probably know what stance I'm taking on it. You know, like, I think we need to be more comfortable speaking outside of our bubbles and be more comfortable with like hearing other opinions and being more comfortable to get out of them for sure.
I actually really need to find some people from like an opposite mindset to mine to have on the podcast.
Cool. That'd be great.
I think it would be really cool. And like, cause yeah, it's not really fair to just have the same types of people on all the time and just be like, this is the way to think. This is the way to think. But like, and like have somebody that would open my eyes and be like, okay, I actually understand your side a lot better now.
Yeah. I think it's one of the coolest things. I'm not really a loyal guy, but like Joe Rogan does a pretty good job of this too, where he kind of becomes just like, he'll bring on anybody, he doesn't care, you know, like, and he'll talk and he'll jam with them and like they'll get a pretty good conversation going and he doesn't really care what their opinion is, he's just there to do it. And I think that that's like a very cool way to operate for sure.
Yeah, he gets on all types.
I mean, he's himself now. I can't stand him talking on his own, but like his interviews are good.
You're working on some stuff in the Fraser River. Can you tell me about what you're working on there?
Yeah, so we're right now running a joint campaign with Georgia Strait Alliance. It's called Treat Our Salish Sea, and we're pushing for a tertiary treatment level to the Iona wastewater facility, which is just by the Vancouver airport. So the wastewater facility basically treats any water that goes down the drain, depending on the respective area that it's in. So Iona in particular treats lots of Metro Vancouver, including like UBC Endowmentlands, Burnaby, Richmond, parts of Steveston, downtown Vancouver. And basically anything that goes down the drain in those areas gets shipped out through pipelines to Iona Wastewater Treatment Plant. And at the plant, the water is treated and then pushed out a 7-kilometer pipe out into the Salish Sea, right at the Fraser River. So if you were to look at it on a map, the left side of it is the Fraser Estuary and the right side of it is the Salish Sea. So for those who don't know, that's a really sensitive habitat for salmon and southern resident killer whales, both endangered keystone species. And what we're pushing for is a higher level of wastewater treatment there. So things that come in through those pipes, like waterborne viruses, microplastics, pharmaceuticals, right now flow right through. The treatment level they have employed doesn't do much besides halt kind of like suspended solids. But what we're talking about in this tertiary treatment is that we can install basically additional filters and settling tanks that will stop all that crap from going out into the ocean.
Even the pharmaceuticals?
Yeah.
Because like you got to imagine the different types of drugs people are flushing down the toilet could be lethal to fish, and or who knows, like, or if it's even researched at all, what really happens?
It's wild. If you Google like wild salmon antidepressants, it's like one of the most common drugs in the Pacific Northwest. Simultaneously, one of the most persistent waterborne drugs in the marine environment. And there's like lots of testing being done on the impacts that antidepressants have on salmon. And some of the biggest things are that it like alters their otolith, which is their ear bones. They know which stream to come back up into. So a lot of them lose their sense of navigation midway through their migratory route, never come back. Another big thing is that it changes, it like messes with their sex ratios. So, and reproductive abilities. So we're losing a lot of reproductive abilities from wild salmon.
So what are we getting more of now? Women or men, or males or females?
It's not really so much their ratios. It's their reproductive abilities, not.
Oh, their ability to reproduce. So the antidepressants, it's kind of like a little known story for most people, unless you're like a, a, a pretty well-educated environmentalist, it's actually really messing up salmon populations and in turn orcas too.
Totally. Yeah. But from a bioaccumulation standpoint, it's a huge mess. It's terrifying. From standpoint of the whales alone, the Salish Sea, right where it spits it out, is considered critical habitat for southern resident killer whales, which is where basically it's a zone where boats can't go over a certain speed, you can't fish, certain regulations that allow them to kind of like have a refuge in the water.
So in what world would that be allowed to flush these things out where you already have a critically endangered species like that, and you're allowed to just keep flushing these things out? So how come they haven't changed yet?
Yeah, unfortunately, our world. But so basically, the plant was built in the 60s. And
years ago.
Yeah, it was built at kind of like the best technology at the time, which is now primary treatment. And a lot of the toxins and stuff we're talking about now didn't exist in the same volume, A, and B, the population wasn't nearly as big as it is now. So we're talking about much higher pressure on the facility. So almost a decade ago, I think 2012, the federal government is demanding that a lot of these treatment facilities be upgraded to a minimum secondary treatment. But that ruling was made before tertiary treatment was really commonplace. And it was also made on the premise that certain facilities get higher treatment level based on where the receiving environment is. So in Ontario, if your wastewater treatment plant goes on, if the receiving environment is a Great Lake, you're going to get tertiary treatment. But for some reason, they didn't think that the Salish Sea and or Fraser River was ecologically significant enough, which is where we're coming in saying that it most certainly is, and it should be treated as a high importance ecosystem.
So is that's your nonprofit and other groups that you're working with, or is it volunteer groups that you volunteer with as well?
Yeah. It's a joint campaign with Georgia Strait Alliance. So we're getting lots of help from lots of their resources, their expertise. It's a true like 50-50 effort, and we're like super grateful. There's a lot of really, really great folks there that I've worked with for a really long time that I look up to on like a personal and professional level. And I don't think we would have come nearly as far as we are now without them. So yeah, we're kind of sitting on like almost 10,000 signatures on a petition, quite a few funds being put towards it, which we've been able to put together some really great resources. And the opportunity to speak at like a municipal level, city hall meetings and stuff.
I think I just signed that today on your website, actually.
I saw it. You did. Can confirm. Much appreciated.
My pleasure. So are you gonna have to go to court for this, or are you just trying to get it to go to court, or what's the next like step that has to happen before they have to upgrade?
I hope we can avoid going to court, but I would. Let it be known, I would go. The next step is basically we're in what's called the project definition phase right now. So they're defining the scope of what the renovation to Iona is going to look like. And they're expected to give a ruling on January 1st.
So if it's a water treatment plant, is this a private company or is this the city of Vancouver that like would have to pay all this money?
It's operated by Metro Vancouver, which is sort of like it's actually a pretty funky model. It's basically like the Greater Vancouver area is kind of serviced by Metro Vancouver, which is technically a corporation. So it's a public amenity. It's going to be paid for by ratepayers. And we're talking to the tune of like $3 to $5 billion.
That's how much it is?
Yeah. So it's a huge piece of infrastructure.
Wow.
The treatment plant alone treats 207 billion liters of water a year. It's one of the biggest like in the country.
Yeah, I'd imagine.
Yeah.
Vancouver is one of our biggest cities.
Yeah. And it's funny when you look at how cost breakdown works, is like that's a huge amount of money to pay for a relatively small population. The amount of people being serviced by it are not really like anything compared to Toronto, for instance. So the federal government basically has shown in historical upgrades that they're willing to contribute more money to the higher level of treatment that's put in. So that's part of our argument as well, in that like if we install tertiary treatment, less money falls on the ratepayers. And even if it does fall on the ratepayers, we want the ratepayers signing our petition, showing that like these ecosystems are important and it's something that ratepayers value.
So how many petitions do you need? Like you said you were almost at 10,000, but is 10,000 enough?
There's no hard number. I think the more the better. I mean, in a perfect world, everybody who's serviced by this treatment plant will sign it, right? I think that would paint a pretty amazing picture for anybody deciding. But the more the better.
In the meantime, can you spread awareness for people to stop flushing their drugs down the toilet?
Yeah. Yes. Please stop flushing your drugs down the toilet. It's a PSA. Pharmaceuticals are like a pretty big concern, especially here. Something that I personally am very sensitive to as well is the downtown east side and like controlled usage centers and uncontrolled usage centers and how those narcotics are making their way into the waterways, which like, you know, a lot of it is controllable and a lot of it is not. And I don't think it should necessarily be the individual's responsibility at that point.
If you're taking antidepressants and you don't have to put them down the toilet at any point, they're supposed to go in you, or you put them in the garbage if you really don't want them. So people just think, oh, I've got drugs, I'll just flush them down the toilet.
It's the toilet. It's also trace amounts. Like if you're consuming certain amounts, it'll come out of your body in different ways.
Oh, so it's in your like poop and pee even that just you doing antidepressants.
In trace amounts, yeah.
Oh, that's a huge problem then.
It's huge. And pharmaceuticals are only one part of this, one piece of the pie as well, right? Like we're talking about microplastics in a pretty big way, which is, you know, going to be one of the most pressing issues of our time, and nobody knows how to stop it. But like, surely here's a very tangible way of decreasing waterborne plastics in a pretty huge way.
There must be bad water treatment plants all over the country and all over the world, and this is just like one that you're concerned about because it affects salmon and killer whales, but there's probably tons that are just as bad or worse than this one.
I think there's a dozen in southern BC that are kind of serviced by the same standards. A lot of them are being upgraded. They'll all have to be upgraded to a minimum standard of secondary by 2030. But there's a ton of wastewater treatment plants, and I think a big thing that we're trying to communicate is that we have this host of problems in waterborne pollutants, like we're talking about, and all these things about people need to, all these at-home solutions, but a lot of them would also be curbed by just increasing wastewater treatment. And I think it needs to become a lot more normalized and a bigger part of like household discussions about ecological significance and protection and how a wastewater treatment plant can come into that.
So if I'm the guy that doesn't want to spend, was it $3 to $5 billion to upgrade the water treatment plant?
Yeah.
What's my argument to you that we don't need it done?
I don't know. a lot of what we've heard is coming from the kind of fiscal conservative type, saying that it's too much money.
It's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money. When you're looking at the difference between the minimum secondary that they've put forward and tertiary, we're looking at only like a 10% increase. So pretty minimal in the relative scheme. Another big thing that we're able to offer with tertiary treatment is called resource reclamation. So you'll be able to use a lot of the inputs going into the plant, like sewage, to offset the energy costs of the facility. So like heating the facility, for instance, can be through sewage. So you're looking at
money
in possible savings that could balance you out the next decade, which is pretty quick.
And you can't really argue with, we can't lose the salmon. We can't really afford to lose the salmon.
I think the opportunity cost of what's at stake here is monumental. And it's actually me. I was having a conversation with someone recently about this, and there's so much research going into solutions to environmental problems, specifically around salmon and killer whales. But like, I don't know if we, it's very hard to paint a picture of what it looks like without these things in play. Like, you're looking at salmon, a keystone species, the lifeblood of British Columbia, and killer whales, an apex predator that regulates the ocean. Like, these are huge, hugely important species.
And I don't know anybody that wants to imagine a world without those.
No, definitely not.
Like, you could,
if you find them, let me know. Let's put them on your podcast. Go head to head.
Yeah, like, even if you're the type of guy that loves making like $100,000 a year on the oil industry or anything, you probably like hunting or fishing, you know? Like,
totally. Yeah. I think everybody has an appeal to it, and I don't know. I'm always hard pressed to find kind of like a reasonable response to somebody who favors profits over the planet to a certain extent. I'm a proponent of everyone living their lives the way that they feel like they should. But at some point, you have to realize that, like, if you're making your money, you're making it to, at the backbone, like, eat food, breathe clean air, drink clean water. And those things just won't exist without a clean ecosystem. And I think we're obviously trending in the wrong way on a huge scale, but on a micro scale, like, there's been a lot of big wins recently as well. And I think that everybody can find a reason to get behind environmental causes.
With all that you've learned throughout your schooling and all the work you've done, is there like one or two main culprits? Can you break it down to a few things that are the real problem with climate change, or is it just way too complex to put it in simple terms?
It's a good question. I think resource extraction is a pretty relevant topic in British Columbia in particular, when we're talking about logging, oil extraction. I would say those are like kind of like the biggest culprits, also the biggest scapegoats. I think like the myriad of environmental issues can run the gamut. We could spend 7 hours talking about particular issues, but
probably more.
Yeah, for sure. I think that there's like, you know, a way that we could be living our lives in a pretty general sense that would change a lot of this. And there's a way that we can be supporting the businesses that make the world the place we want to live in. And there's a way that we can be supporting organizations and like the causes in a more specific way.
Do you, in your life, do you try to know where all your products that you buy come from?
Yeah, for sure. We're pretty conscious. We have a lot of stuff. We're like having a yard sale tomorrow, which is hilarious. And we're just like sorting through all the crap we have in our house. But yeah, we definitely try and be really conscious. My girlfriend and I, in terms of like our household consumption, we do all we can to kind of like support our friends' brands and cool things that people we know are doing and people in our community that we support. And I think that's like, at that point, price becomes immaterial. We want to be examples of what we preach, for sure.
I started buying like almost all organic and like hardly eating any meat.
But cool. Yeah.
I thought about going vegan, but I'm just mostly vegan.
Cool. That's awesome. I think like however people interpret it, as long as they're thinking about it, is a step in the right direction. And I think at some point we're going to get a lot more clear answers in terms of like how many people pick up things like vegan diets and stuff. And I think we need to see it on like a pretty large scale to see how it's going to impact the world. But I think it's like, you know, to someone who isn't open-minded to it, I just want to know why not, you know, like it's.
I think a lot of it is just not being educated. Like I'm finding out more and more stuff all the time where I didn't even realize how big, if at all, something was a problem, or how big of a problem something was.
Right.
And then, or like when I, definitely not when I was young, when like, when you were like, I'm going to go do environmental science because the developers are trying to destroy the wetlands by my home. Like, I wasn't thinking about stuff like that. I was just thinking about buying new shoes and going to parties with my friends. Like I wasn't aware of how bad the environment was, and like I wasn't thinking about climate change, and I'm slowly getting more and more aware. Like I think it's easy to not focus on that. Like a lot of people just want a nice car to drive down the street with and pick up girls.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that they like part of my shtick is like I'm a regular guy. I like those things as well. You know, like I love snowboarding. I love surfing. Like these are things that I love to do, and those are things that I also find important in my life. And it's not like everything about my 12 waking hours a day. Hopefully I'm awake for more than 12 hours a day.
Well,
You know, in November in Southern British Columbia, I'm not. So, I think that they like everyone has to find their way to do their thing and live the way that they want to live. And a lot of the importance that I put in my life is like, I love my work. I love contributing to the things that I'm passionate about, and I love doing the things that I love. Like,
would you have a job like yours where it's actually for a cause and a meaning that you're really behind? It must, the idea of doing anything that you're not so involved in personally, and that you don't believe in, must be like impossible to think about. Like you probably would never want to just do something just for a paycheck after having like a real sense of satisfaction like you get.
totally. It's a tough pill to swallow. I don't know what I would do. I'd like to think that I'm hardworking enough to muscle through it, but it's a tough pill to swallow. I don't know what I'd do if someone was like, okay, you're now a barista 7 days a week. Not that there's anything wrong with being a barista, right?
No, but it's
But
not as
I think it's
satisfying
more,
as saving the planet.
my fulfillment is really important from a career perspective. And that
Okay.
also comes with like a huge place of privilege as well. Like I think that my upbringing, where I came from, plays a big part in that. And I was afforded a lot of these luxuries to be able to do that, which I'm really grateful for. And it's just part of what's become my reality for sure.
Do you think if we lived in a planet where we were living more sustainably and if we were already living in harmony with nature and you didn't have to think about protecting the planet as your job, do you think there's something else that you would have loved to spend your whole life pursuing?
Well, good question. I don't know.
The
I
top
would
one too.
snowboard. I would snowboard every day. I'd have five slides, go on heli trips whenever I can. I think I'd probably live pretty differently if I didn't have that on my conscience.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that for myself too, because it really consumes you after a while, and it's important, and it probably should consume you. But like, it would be nice not to have to worry about it.
Oh yeah, for sure. For sure. And I think it's like, I don't know, as much as you think about it, I think about it a lot. My proximity to it is crazy. Like the amount of news stories I read on a daily basis is pretty overwhelming. So maybe we are more out of the woods of it than I think, but I think it just needs to become ingrained in people. Like that is our reality for sure. And once you start thinking about it the other way and kind of just like living with no caution in the air, it's a pretty dangerous scenario, but it's also how a lot of people have been living until pretty
Yeah,
recently.
I think it would be really nice, just the ignorance is bliss route, and then you're just like, oh no, it doesn't matter if I buy a big truck and drive it all over and have two sleds and a big boat. Like that would be really fun. That sounds
I'm
really
sure a
fun.
lot of people live like that.
Yeah,
I know a
like
lot of people live like that.
that sounds great. It's
Yeah.
just it's not realistic.
It's not realistic. It's not realistic. And I think like that, those are the people that definitely need a good shake. And you're like, great. Like you have your sled for what? Like this snowpack that's receded 30
Yeah.
of the last 32 years, you know? Like, yeah.
But anyway, Zach, I think I'm gonna let you go, but thank you so much for the great conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. I appreciate your time. I appreciate your questions.
All right, yeah, thanks a lot, man. That was great.
Right on. Yeah, that was great.
But all right, well, have a good night in Vancouver, and keep in touch.
Thank you. Yeah, take care. We'll chat soon.
That was guest Zach Shum founder of Obabaka Consulting. My next guest is Alex Harrow. Alex is an editor at The Inertia, an online surf magazine that is well respected and known in the surf community. Thank you so much for listening to Their Life Story podcast. If you like what you hear, please feel free to write a review in iTunes. It goes a long way in helping to get those hard-to-get guests. I'd like to give a special thanks this episode to my girlfriend Nikki for not getting frustrated when I just need to work on my podcast all the time.